Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to our special series on my PhD thesis. After introducing the concept in Chapter 1, here we explore insult in more detail and across a wide variety of circumstances. Insults, according to the understanding of national honour at the time, and some asserted, according to its inflexible logic, always required a response. Responses to insult could come in the form of coercive diplomacy or military intervention, but the goal was to obtain satisfaction, which would repel these insults and uphold national honour inviolate. As we see here, this requirement for satisfaction was not in fact as rigid as was claimed. Insults precipitated serious discussions, but the question of how to proceed revolved around the actual circumstances and the potential opportunities therein. For instance, one needs only to compare how Britain reacted to the insults delivered by China and Afghanistan to see that non-European powers were treated with far less tolerance than Europeans. Insults from these theatres, outside of Europe, didn't merely demand a response, they also suggested threats to British influence and prestige if this response wasn't impressive enough. Then again, if the offending power was comparatively weak, as China turned out to be, but did exist in Europe, the procedure was more complicated. Madrid's striking insult, which we will explore in a later episode, shows that not all insults required war to be resolved. Instead, the order of the day was forbearance, a position which was never offered to China during the Opium War. Conversely, when the Greek government delivered its insult to the person of David Pacifico in 1847, years of uncooperative Greek behaviour, coupled with Palmerston's impatience at Athens' intransigence, pushed Britain to the brink of war not only with Greece, but Russia and France as well. Once again, Palmerston had to hold his nerve, and this Don Pacifico affair, which we'll look at in later episodes, wrought him even greater political acclaim than his stand against France a decade before. But before we get to all that, we have to consider what an insult was and how it could be delivered. We also need to examine the circumstances of the Opium War more closely and consider how important the insult was, delivered by China, to Britain. Did this war merely exist for economic interests, above all the opium trade, or was the reality more nuanced? Furthermore, while the government enjoyed support, a considerable faction of opinion insisted that a war which would reinforce the opium trade was not just a bad policy, but also inherently dishonourable. Would Britain invite shame upon itself for forcing the opium trade upon the Chinese, or was it simply the case that the rhetoric of honour demanded a scapegoat and Palmerston was happy to oblige? We may never know the extent to which national honour mattered to advocates of the Opium War, but what we can be certain of is that contemporaries used the rhetoric of honour to make their case, and that this case would have been substantively blunted without national honour to paper over the cracks. Without any further ado, it's time we got into this, as I take you to the First Opium War, and also the second chapter of my thesis. Chapter 2, Insult, Forbearance and Satisfaction in British Foreign Policy, 1838-1850. Introduction. In Avner Offer's 1995 article, Going to War in 1914, A Matter of Honour, the author investigated honour as a code of conduct on the threshold of war. Avner Offer maintained that honour can be seen as a script which follows a prescribed sequence, adding, honour is a quality assumed to be in the possession of individuals and groups until it is challenged and questioned. Some experience or episode is interpreted as a challenge to honour. When this challenge is received by a nation, Offer determined, the remedy is violence, preceded by the polite manoeuvres and language of diplomacy. If satisfaction is denied, there is a loss of reputation, status, honour. The violence is then redirected and internalised as humiliation and shame. The code of honour, Offer continued, is a cultural script, but it would be wrong to regard it as irrational. Offer concluded that the First World War was a chain of insults that no leader in a position of public visibility could afford to ignore. An honourable nation, much like an honourable man, must respond to insult or be perceived as weak, vulnerable to exploitation by opportunistic rivals. This honour script was not the central thesis of Offer's study, but it is worth bringing it under closer analysis for this chapter, which considers how Britain responded to insults in three distinct theatres. These include the First Opium War, the abrupt expulsion of Ambassador Bulwer from Madrid in 1848, and the Don Pacifico affair. What does this honour script reveal, or fail to reveal, about how insults were received? As the repelling of insult was central to the honour script's logic, one suspects that it would place restrictions upon contemporaries, reducing the opportunities for compromise. In fact, this chapter demonstrates that in British foreign policy, the nature of insult was more nuanced and heavily dependent upon circumstances. An analysis of public rhetoric aids this assessment because it demonstrates how ministers used the language of honour both to press and to avoid the demands which the honour script prescribed. Furthermore, this chapter shows the extent to which opposition figures used this rhetoric against the government, covering much of their criticism in the language of honour to make their case. In this sense, national honour was as much a tool of the politician as it was an ingrained belief system. One could argue that the more anxious quests for redress were contained in the colonial sphere, where British interests in India compelled the government to act swiftly to repel insult from the Chinese in 1839 or in Afghanistan in 1842. In these theatres, insults in the form of mistreated citizens or military disaster necessitated a retributive campaign to recoup lost honour and demonstrate prestige to Britain's main rival, Russia. Although in the main, the search for satisfaction followed an insult, the honour script's tenets were not law. Exceptions to this script exist, most strikingly in the case of Spain in 1848, when the insult of Ambassador Bulwer's abrupt expulsion from Madrid was presented by the government as an opportunity to exhibit forbearance. In addition, insult must be considered in the context of Britain's relationship with the offender. The Don Pacifico case in 1850 was pursued with vigour due to Greece's recent history of offences towards the country, of which Don Pacifico's treatment was perceived as the final straw. Insults could be incurred through a variety of mediums, but the most common was through the mistreatment of a British subject, whether they were imprisoned by a foreign government or not afforded proper respect according to traditional protocols. The previous chapter demonstrated how ideas such as good faith, obligation, and prestige were used as synonyms of national honour and pressed by contemporary public rhetoric. Similarly, insult was a synonym for the national honour in danger, and rhetoric was most belligerent when it was incurred. To erase this insult, Britain had to rectify the situation, an outcome referred to invariably as reparation, redress, or satisfaction. As the duelist could acquire satisfaction if his opponent apologised, so could nations erase the insult through an official apology. However, as will be seen below, it was occasionally necessary or even beneficial to make a display of military power in a campaign to wrest this satisfaction by force. Part 1. Insult, Immorality, and Vindication in Asia, 1839-1842. In March 1839, years of deteriorating Sino-British relations culminated in the imprisonment of Captain Elliot, Britain's superintendent in Canton, and the seizure of £2 million worth of opium. The Chinese emperor had charged Commissioner Lin with removing the drug, and Lin's single-minded focus towards this end proved pivotal. Lin presided over Elliot's detention, and during the summer and autumn, several skirmishes increased tensions. On the 26th of November, Lin announced his intention to permanently ban British trade from China, an intolerable prospect for British mercantile and free trade interests. During the late 1830s, Captain Elliot had warned London of Chinese anger at his inability to halt the export of opium into Canton, mostly cultivated in India. The Whig government, led by Lord Melbourne, hesitated to open another conflict in a distant theatre, but it now seemed fatal to back down before Chinese insult. By seeking satisfaction through war, Britain could also force the restoration of stable trading relations, particularly involving tea. In his 2003 study, Glenn Melanchon identified national honour as the primary cause of the First Opium War. This presents an opportunity to assess secondary literature, which is unfortunately lacking from other chapters in this research project. Innovative and important though it was, Melanchon's approach did not escape scrutiny. George Bernstein believed that it was ultimately not clear that Melanchon was justified in making the jump that assigns honour as Palmerston's primary motive for action. Margaret Lamb perceived that Melanchon muddied his own argument to some extent by a liberal use of the word honour to cover a variety of meanings. It could be argued that Melanchon did not sufficiently distinguish between honour as a motive and honour as a political tool, a tool which ministers used to shield policy from the opposition and which the opposition could leverage against the government. Indeed, this study departs from Melanchon's effort to attribute the vindication of national honour as the primary cause of British participation in the First Opium War. Instead, it will consider how contemporaries used the rhetoric of honour in their framing, defence, and criticism of policy. As will be demonstrated below, such tactics were not always sophisticated or consistent. Contemporaries were certainly distracted by the preponderance of several foreign policy challenges occurring simultaneously, including a crisis in Afghanistan, pivotal negotiations with Washington, and the resolution of the Eastern Question. This expansive workload may have contributed to Palmerston's inability to keep pace with Captain Elliot's warnings in the first place, facilitating an administrative failure so blatant that only by leveraging the national honour could the ministry be saved. For supporters of the war, and for its critics, the rhetoric of honour was sufficiently pliable to accommodate their positions. This included the awkward hypocrisy of advocating a war with China, which would expand the opium trade, particularly as critics conceived of the trade as dishonourable and disgraceful in its character. While private correspondence reveals anger over the insult to British honour, it was also true that the government were under pressure to obtain compensation for influential opium traders in the mercantile lobby. This stemmed from Captain Elliot's written commitment that he would arrange reimbursement for the opium traders to compensate for their seized opium, provoking parliamentary debates lasting longer than the war itself. Melanchon observed this pressure but did not dwell on why failing to honour Elliot's vow would harm Lord Melbourne's administration. Until the dilemma was resolved, it called the government's good faith and honour into question. Members with Chinese interests leveraged the ethic against Peel's government from 1841 and even connected the reimbursement of opium traders with Britain's position in India, arguing that opium producers there would be ruined if they were not compensated immediately, while Britain's claim to rule would be damaged. It is worth considering whether these individuals appreciated that the rhetorical power of honour would serve their case better than private lobbying, and made use of these tools at their disposal to press their case. It was certainly a more effective representation than pressing for compensation for purely financial reasons in the name of a trade which was under scrutiny. Interestingly, when Sir Robert Peel's administration addressed the compensation issue, it urged members to wait until the end of the war, when the Chinese could be pressed to pay these costs in Britain's name. Coercing the Chinese to compensate the opium traders was certainly an attractive prospect for a government repeatedly running a budget deficit. The debate represents one example of how the rhetoric of honour was used during the crisis, and it could be argued that Melanchon did not sufficiently explore the extent of the ethics application. James L. Hevia believed Melanchon's singular focus upon honour was questionable, recommending a more in-depth examination of the honour ethic, adding that one can easily see the potential of such an analysis. Notwithstanding its flaws, Melanchon's study was an important first step in contextualising national honour within British foreign policy. This task is complemented by an examination of contemporary rhetoric, parliamentary debates during the First Opium War reveal several themes, including the vindication of honour by acquiring satisfaction for the Chinese insult, the dishonour involved in the opium trade, the need to defend British prestige and its reputation in India, and the idea that Whig mismanagement and complacency imperiled the national honour in China. Initially, however, Melbourne's administration was slow to use national honour and presided over a surprisingly secretive policy. The 1840 session began with a vote of confidence in the ministry, which survived by 21 votes. Parliamentary evidence reveals the extent to which the government obfuscated. As the session progressed, greater information was requested on the nature of trade relations with China, on the fate of the surrendered opium, on rumours of an expedition against China, and on the need for official papers. When he finally addressed the situation in the House of Commons on the 12th of March, Lord John Russell clarified that there had been no declaration of war, but that preparations for an expedition were being made by the Governor-General of India. Ironically, the Times interpreted Russell's explanation as a declaration of war, and this impression spread from mid-March 1840. The Times was inherently critical of British policy towards China from an early stage, and had consistently argued that the government was responsible for the deterioration in Sino-British relations. It blamed government incompetence for the war, and warned that Britain's rivals would take advantage of her distraction. It attacked the Blue Books on Chinese correspondence as inadequate, asserted that the war was un-Christian, and lamented that "This country has been plunged into the most inglorious and dishonourable of wars by opium smugglers, and the influence which those who employ opium smugglers exercise upon the national councils." The Times also criticised the government's lack of detail and feared the war's financial implications. A survey of newspaper opinion suggests some were unsure if Britain was at war or not, amid a general lack of enthusiasm for war. Still, since it was known that an expedition was en route to China, on the 19th of March 1840, Russell clarified its goals. It was sent to obtain reparation for the insults and injuries offered to Her Majesty's superintendent, that is, Captain Elliot, to obtain for the merchants trading with China an indemnification for the loss of their property, and finally to obtain security that the persons and property of those trading with China should in future be protected from insult or injury. This seemed to confirm that war with China was inevitable, if not already a fact. Yet the cabinet's strategy remained defensive. It made no substantive effort to mobilise parliamentary opinion towards war. The opposition consistently requested more details, responsibility for the opium trade was debated, and an opium committee was discussed, though concerns over composition delayed its creation. When the official documents were finally provided, accusations that Palmerston had modified the Blue Book to protect himself added to the frustration, as did the enormous size of the material itself. One advantage in the government's possession was the insult which had been inflicted upon Elliot's person, and thus upon Britain itself. If the government could emphasise this insult and press the need for vindication, the rhetoric of honour could legitimise their policy and shield it from substantial criticism. Unfortunately for Melbourne's administration, their opponents were already conceiving of methods where the rhetoric of honour could be deployed in their favour. Thus, the Exeter and Plymouth Gazette suggested that the Tories should attack the government for its policy failures, while also demanding satisfaction from the Celestial Empire for insults offered to our representative and the barbarous and cruel outrages committed by the Chinese upon unoffending British subjects. For those that might wonder how the opposition could balance these goals, the Gazette insisted, "The justification of war for protection and the maintenance of the national honour and character under present circumstances, and the necessity for this measure of self-defence having been brought about through the negligence and incapacity of ministers, are two distinct questions." It was this negligence and incapacity that the opposition sought to use as their basis for attack, not the desire to redeem the national honour. As it would have been politically impossible to argue against vindication, the opposition would instead present their motion as an attack upon the want of foresight and precaution on the part of Her Majesty's present advisers in respect to our relations with China, and especially to their neglect in not furnishing the British superintendent at Canton with proper instructions. Indeed, this was the approach which the high Tory and anti-reformer Sir James Graham adopted when he censured the government for its China policy during a significant three-day debate on the 7th of April 1840. Bypassing the cabinet's claims that war had not been declared, Graham charged them with the want of foresight and precaution required to avoid war, and with a failure to provide powers and instructions calculated to provide against the growing evils connected with the contraband traffic in opium. Graham prefaced his attack by insisting that if he could believe that we were called upon to enter into this war, not only to punish those who slighted us, but in the necessary defence of our national honour, then he was persuaded that the whole martial spirit of the country would gird itself up for the conflict and meet the danger without fear or anxiety. It was because the government had repeatedly failed to heed Elliot's warnings, prepare for Chinese countermeasures, or halt the production of opium, that Britain's position in China had so markedly deteriorated, and Graham believed neither Parliament nor the public should have to suffer for these failures. Secretary for War Thomas Babington Macaulay, a popular radical recently brought into the cabinet, disagreed that the government were capable of halting the opium trade, reminding members that tobacco and brandy were regularly smuggled into the British Isles. Macaulay could have drawn from available papers to show that nearly 180,000 pounds of opium were imported into Britain in 1839, but he did not. He presented a familiar principle, soon pursued in the MacLeod controversy and reiterated in the Don Pacifico affair a decade later, that British citizens were under the government's protection wherever they resided, and that such protection was entwined with the national honour. The independent Tory Sir George Staunton, a former resident of Canton and scholar in Chinese, rejoiced that the opposition's view that the war about to be undertaken in China was most atrociously unjust and dishonourable to this country was not held by the majority. Staunton warned that if we submitted to the degrading insults of China, the time would not be far distant when our political ascendancy in India would be at an end. Still, the opium trade and its well-publicised evils were an awkward fit with a supposedly honourable administration. Reverend A.S. Thelwall's pamphlet, The Iniquities of the Opium Trade, published in 1839, established a powerful moral argument against Britain's role in the drug's production and exportation, while making substantial use of the lexicon of honour to justify its opposition. Thelwall's pamphlet was widely referenced and affirmed the connection between national dishonour and the immoral opium trade. It could be used alongside accusations of mismanagement and inefficiency in recent Sino-British relations to cast a damning picture of the government's real culpability for the crisis. In response, ministers would attempt to simplify the conflict, pressing the necessity of vindicating the Chinese insult and excusing all other circumstances as immaterial to this main aim. John Hobhouse, president of the Board of Control, refocused the debate onto the Chinese insult, lamenting that he ought to have known that those who would not like to vote anything against the national honour or against the opium trade in India would nevertheless be very glad to give a vote against the government. The opposition's speeches, Hobhouse complained, contained no assertions that our honour had been sacrificed or that the glory of our flag had been tarnished. Hobhouse insisted that the expedition was inherently necessary because, according to the united opinion of the British merchants at Canton, by truckling and yielding to the Chinese authorities, we should gain nothing but disgrace. Hobhouse did not accept government responsibility for the traffic of opium through India and China. It was an old sin, if it was a sin at all. He would never approve of a war unless, from the conviction that he did so with just grounds on his side, and he only trusted that if we did enter upon this expedition with honour and justice on our side, then it should be done, in a way to vindicate our own honour and to improve the relations of this great empire with all the others in the universe. Sir Robert Peel's speech on the final day of the debate was arguably representative of the Conservative line of attack. He asserted that the war itself might be politic, yet the necessity of the war might have arisen from impolitic proceedings. It was possible that an act of violence and outrage might have been committed, which left no alternative but a resort to war. But the necessity of the war could not disguise the gross negligence and misconduct of the ministers, nor could it protect the government from the established norms of criticism in debate. Although Melanchthon noted the simplicity of Peel's speech, this was in fact an effective method for bypassing the rhetoric of honour by reminding the House of the original errors which had made vindication necessary. As Peel could not critique the act of vindication itself, he highlighted how the government had left Captain Elliot in such a disadvantageous position. Peel challenged why Elliot had not been given the sufficient powers and authority which the honour and the commercial interests of this country rendered absolutely necessary. The government's poor conduct had made war inevitable, but Peel reminded members of Britain's past insults to China while warning of the impact which excess might have on Sino-British trade, regardless of success in the looming war. Peel concluded that it is your duty to vindicate the honour of England where vindication is necessary and to demand reparation wherever reparation is due. Yet he did hope and pray that God would avert from them the calamities and turn from us the evils which, I must say, the neglect and incapacity of our rulers have most righteously deserved. Palmerston accepted this principle and was glad to hear Peel's declaration that it was necessary that measures should be taken to vindicate the honour of the British flag and the dignity of the British crown. Palmerston suggested that was the general opinion of the House and of those parties in the country who were most interested in the question. Palmerston shared Peel's wish that vindication should not become vindictiveness and that essentially the punishment should not exceed the Chinese crime of insult. He read letters from American and British merchants which validated the government's decision to send an expedition. Graham's motion evaded all the real and substantial merits of the question and distracted the House with flawed criticisms of British officials dating back several years, who, Palmerston upheld, the Blue Books cleared of wrongdoing. But the press remained largely critical of the government's position. The London Evening Standard encapsulated the opposition's position when it charged that points of trade had been, by the mismanagement of the government, inflamed into questions of national honour. The Times blamed Melbourne's administration for its tameness under injury and slowness to resent, reminding readers that it had long recommended a vigorous tone towards unfriendly governments, but that instead, we perceived so much inertness and such manifest feebleness and everything to invite aggression by unfriendly powers and nothing to deter from it. This theme was arguably pressed more forcibly in the press than in Parliament. Weakness, in a military or prestige sense, would compel rivals to take advantage, a belief espoused by the conservative Blackwood's magazine. Sympathetic organs continued their own campaigns. The Globe charged the opposition with cynicism, and the Morning Chronicle reiterated the importance of redress in the face of blatant Chinese insults. We're going to leave our coverage there as we reflect on the above section for a moment. Clearly, there was a willingness to use national honour as a political tool in public debate. We see the opposition taking the curious position of criticising the decision to make war on the Chinese. By focusing on the government's mismanagement of Chinese affairs, which had rendered this expedition to redeem national honour necessary in the first place. By attacking the government's negligence and incapacity, members could attempt to score political points and increase the pressure while adhering to the demands of the honour script. Certainly, the government upheld this honour script in its response to the Chinese insult, yet we have also shown that going as far as Glenn Melanchthon did in attributing national honour as the major cause of the Opium War is somewhat simplistic. Melanchthon did not distinguish between the rhetoric of honour and the belief in national honour, a difficult task for sure, but he also did not explore the ethic himself, neglecting, for instance, to shed any light on the motives of opium suppliers or those opponents of the opium trade on the other side, both of whom used the rhetoric of national honour for their own ends, and who, we can assume, at least to a certain extent, believed in what they were saying. Melanchthon's claim that national honour was the cause of the Opium War is thus reductionist, but it does present us with interesting ideas to consider. Language of this kind was easier to deploy against a non-European state like China, which it was said had been insulting London for years and demanding humiliating practices like kowtowing to the emperor in return for tea. The opium drug proved surprisingly useful in this scenario. The influx of opium into China facilitated the exit of large quantities of silver, which then flowed into the East India Company and funded future campaigns. Of course, the threat to India, which would follow any unsuccessful Chinese campaigns, demanded that the Whigs take the China War seriously, and whatever the political motives, it is hard to deny that Britain's military capacity received extensive kudos for its systematic destruction of the Chinese. By the end of the war, the Celestial Empire was clearly beaten and close to collapse, while Britain had demonstrated its prestige and military prowess, and gained a handy outlet in Hong Kong. Was it merely a happy coincidence that such a boon to Britain's trade had been acquired when satisfaction was supposedly the main aim? Palmerston certainly claimed as much, but we are bound to be more suspicious. We will finish our coverage of the Chinese conflict and its Afghan counterpart in the next episode, so I hope you'll join me for that as we approach this fascinating conflict from a very different angle. There was certainly more to the Opium War than meets the eye, just as there was more to the rhetoric of national honour than contemporaries may have claimed. I hope you're enjoying this analysis, history friend. We will continue our investigation next week, so thank you so much for listening and supporting this show. A huge thanks goes out to you. My name is Zach, and I'll be seeing you all soon.